the fear of positioning. A narrow focus creates opportunities. For vivid proof, consider Scandinavian Airlines. In 1980, faced with $20 million in losses, SAS executives decided to position the airline as the business traveler's airline. Listen carefully and you can almost hear all the way from Stockholm the hollering that preceded that decision. What? And sacrifice tourist travelers? Run ads with blonde yuppies in power suits? The tourists will ditch us. We have to address them. The sacrificers, however, won their argument for the business traveler's position. And they won something else. More tourist customers. By filling up so many seats with full-fare passengers, SAS could offer even lower fares to tourists. In short, positioning SAS as the most desirable airline for business travelers made it the most desirable airline to business travelers and tourists. To broaden your appeal, narrow your position. Halo effects. Why do people in services fear positioning so much? Because they fear that standing for one thing will limit their appeal. But it doesn't work that way, for one important reason. People associate one positive thing with many other good things. Say one positive thing, and you will become associated with many. No two services are the same. In a positioning exercise, if you ask a principal of a service company, what makes your service different, you often get a disappointing response. Honestly, nothing. We're all pretty much the same. History shows that everything can be made different. Two services cannot be virtually identical in the people they attract, the work they inspire, the information and training they pass on, the rate at which they learn, or the efficiency with which they work. It is impossible. Human beings are too different, and their interactions in different environments only magnify those differences. What's more, prospects perceive services as different. Identifying and communicating those differences and creating new ones are central to successful marketing. If you cannot see the difference in your service, look harder. Position is a passive noun, not an active verb. We want to position ourselves as the market leader, say several million executives each year. They cannot do it for one simple reason. No company can position itself as anything. You can focus your efforts and your message, which sometimes can influence your position, but your position is a place, and someone else puts you there, your prospects. However, you can take your position and turn it to your benefit. No marketer ever followed this principle as brilliantly as Avis Rent-A-Car. Lagging behind Hertz for years in the 1960s and early 1970s, and saddled with its second-place position, the company decided to make second-best a more desirable position than first. "We're number two," Avis ads repeated. "We try harder." People believed it. Sales soared. Don't start by positioning your service. Instead, leverage the position you have. Creating your positioning statement. A position, or statement of position, is a cold-hearted, no-nonsense statement of how you are perceived in the minds of prospects. It is your position. A positioning statement, by contrast, states how you wish to be perceived. It is the core message you want to deliver in every medium to influence the perceptions of your service. You can establish your positioning statement by answering the following questions. Who? Who are you? What? What business are you in? For whom? What people do you serve? What need? What are the special needs of the people you serve? Against whom? With whom are you competing? What's different? What makes you different from those competitors? Finally, what's the benefit? What unique benefit does a client derive from your service? Ask yourself these seven questions and have seven good, clear answers. How to narrow the gap between your position and your positioning statement. Getting prospects to move from how they see you to how you wish them to see you may require a huge push. And the wider the gap between your position and your statement, the stronger you must push. Ask yourself, Given our position, will people believe our positioning statement? This problem often arises when a small or mid-sized service tries to pitch that it is the premier provider of its service. Few prospects can reconcile small or mid-sized with premier provider. The claim fails the laugh test. A similar problem occurs when a service with a well-entrenched position creates a new positioning statement that does not fit its established position. Take this frequent case in retailing. Milt Franklin starts off in bowling supplies. He calls his company All Star Bowling. Prospects position Milt as a bowling supply provider. Slowly, Milt learns that bowling supplies barely cover his overhead. So, he adds golf supplies. Even though bowlers and golfers are continents apart demographically, and even though few golfers would believe a bowling supply salesman knows Tommy Armour 845s from Colt 45s, having diversified, Milt tacks onto All Star Bowling a new theme line. Bowling, and a whole lot more. These and a whole lot more themes which abound in America are a sure sign that the store owner has made a positioning mistake. Clients like Milt often name themselves into these problems and then try to rename their way back. Something to consider before you call your restaurant Harry's Hoagies, say. But the anchoring principle warns you, most people get anchored to your initial position and will not accept the new position if the gap between them is too wide. In positioning, you have to jump from lily pad to nearby lily pad one at a time. If the gap between your position and your positioning statement is too big, your customers won't make the leap. Keep your steps small. If that isn't our positioning statement, what is it? A $2,000 overly bold positioning statement that tries to leap over too many lily pads still has value. It can be, and probably is, your goal. Keep it. It can motivate people. Define your long-term goals and guide your mission statement and long-term plan. It gives you an end in mind. Have big goals and great visions, but make sure they're goals and visions and not positioning statements. Craft bold dreams and realistic positioning statements. Focus. What Sears may have learned. If you're old enough to remember when bankers were the big shots in every town and when UNIVAC was the world's most famous computer, you can also remember when Sears was America's department store. Years later, bankers have been the victims of inertia, UNIVAC is a memory, and Sears is a near casualty of the focus wars in department stores. Amazingly, even while Americans seem more interested in austerity, Neiman Marcus appears to be thriving thanks to a position that can best be described as the purveyor of stuff to die for. Walmart is the terror of every small-town retailer, thanks to an equally clear focus on good stuff so damn cheap you won't believe it. And Bloomingdale's, while not the supernova it was in the 80s, still attracts a good business by focusing on shopping as entertainment. Sears, in the first half of the 1900s, on the other hand, became the victim of focusing on nothing, or, more accurately, on everything. Sears had always touted its high-quality durable goods, such as lawnmowers. Now, Sears started stressing its softer side, its clothing and linens, a difficult marketing combination. Sears started with very low prices. Then, hoping to improve margins and attract what executives thought was a growing and lasting supply of cost-be-damned yuppies, they tried to move prices up. Sears quickly discovered that if you do not have a focus, you soon might not have a business. Sales and profits plummeted. All that made Sears tolerable to its shareholders were the corporation's repair centers, Allstate Insurance, the Discover Card, and the underlying value of the company's real estate holdings. In late 1995, however, the stores showed signs of rallying. By December 1995, same-store sales increased almost 6% despite a sluggish retail economy. Sears' major weapon in the rebound was an intense focus on the store's softer side. Executives decided to let the impressive word of mouth for Sears' durable goods drive that portion of its business. They moved furniture out into separate, freestanding furniture stores. Then, with aggressive, softer side advertising, the addition of more national clothing brands, wider aisles, softer lighting, and fancier displays, they drove up women's clothing sales 10% an important improvement for a chain in which women make more than 70% of the purchases. It appears that Sears' focus on the softer and higher margin portion of its business might revive the stores. If you think you can afford not to focus, think of Sears. Focus and the Clinton campaign. He was dying. Bill Clinton had taken too many blows in the 1992 Democratic presidential primaries. Almost everyone involved with the campaign thought the end was near. Clinton's problem was not his alleged fondness for women other than Hillary Clinton. It was his apparent fondness for chaos. He gave one speech one night and another the next with no common themes. Midway through the campaign, however, and with one dramatic gesture, campaign manager James Carville turned Clinton's entire campaign around with four words. "It's the economy, stupid." From that moment, the campaign rarely lost the focus. Now, Clinton hammered on the economy repeatedly, and eventually he hammered that message right through George Bush's heart. Clinton aimed at the core of Americans, their historic materialism and their fears in the middle of a long recession, and repeatedly spoke to them. He became the economy candidate, the one who would address that problem. And despite all the rumors and all the suspicions, despite a controversial wife and a style that caused people to mistrust him, Clinton won. Focus won. Focus. In everything from campaigns for peanuts to campaigns for president, focus wins. The sheer illogic of pricing. A Denver woman needed to sell four reasonably cute cats. She placed this classified ad in the Denver Post. "Ugly cats, $100 each, 555-5555. More than 80 people called. She said she could have sold the cats for far more. Don't assume that logical pricing is smart pricing. Maybe your price, which makes you look like a good value, actually makes you look second rate. Avoiding the deadly middle. Companies in many services essentially set their rates by studying the going, high, and low rates, and then deciding where they fall on the quality spectrum. This unfortunate practice tells their customers exactly how good the company really thinks it is. Another problem with this pricing strategy is the problem of the deadly middle. If you are a high-priced provider, most people assume that you offer the best quality, a desirable position. If you are the lowest-priced provider, most people assume you deliver an acceptable product at the lowest cost, also a desirable position. But if you price in the middle, you're saying, we're not the best, and neither is our price, but both our service and price are pretty good. Not very compelling message. Beware the deadly middle. The low-cost trap. You can make a good marketing case for becoming the low-cost provider, but the low-cost position kills. The great low-price providers take it from several directions. Cutting costs requires little imagination, and the low-cost position can be seized without a large investment in brand building. So, in most non-retail service industries, the low-cost provider is a relatively easy market niche to enter. Just when you perfect your system for reducing costs, someone else devises a better one, as discount retailers discovered when Walmart jumped in. Many low-cost providers attain their position through ruthless dealing with suppliers. Over the short term, that squeezing can work. Suppliers who need the business grudgingly oblige, but those suppliers never become allies. They even may generate bad word of mouth to compensate for the bad treatment they receive. If those suppliers get a good chance to get out of the deal years later, they do, gleefully, bad word of mouth trailing them as they flee. Cost shavers also find it harder to inspire employees. Employees often see a company's intelligent austerity as mean-spirited cheapness. In the Harvard Business Review, in its September-October 1980 issue, William Hall reported his study comparing companies that stressed differentiation with companies that competed on cost. In every measure that mattered, in return on equity, return on capital, and average annual revenue growth rate, the differentiators beat the tightwads every time. Remember, people almost always can find a cheaper way to get your service, and few efforts are less rewarding than trying to compete with those cheaper ways. Beware of the rock bottom. Pricing, a lesson from Picasso. In many services, overnight delivery, dry cleaning, fast foods, the product of the service has become a commodity, and commodity pricing rules prevail. To the low-priced go the spoils. But in millions of other services, pricing is a not-so-simple matter of what will the market bear? Film directors, great photographers, top consultants, and many others charge enough to buy Monets. What is talent and thought worth? And why is some worth so much? Before you answer, consider this story about Pablo Picasso. A woman was strolling along a street in Paris when she spotted Picasso sketching at a sidewalk cafe. The woman asked Picasso if he might sketch her and charge accordingly. Picasso obliged. In just minutes, there she was, an original Picasso. "And what do I owe you?" she asked. 5,000 francs, he answered. "But it only took you 3 minutes," she politely reminded him. "No," Picasso said. "It took me all my life." Don't charge by the hour. Charge by the years. Value is not a position. If your primary selling position is good value, you have no position. Value is what every service promises, implicitly or explicitly. It is fundamental to survival. A service's price must fairly reflect its value to the customer, or the service eventually will fail. In services, value is a given, and givens are not viable competitive positions. If good value is the first thing you communicate, you won't be effective. If good value is your best position, improve your service. If you need a name for your service, start with your own. Names, the information per inch test. Why do many Fortune 500 companies pay over $35,000 for a name? Because names make a company's first impression. First impressions count and often convey much of the little information about you that your prospects have. Put the name to this test. How much valuable information per inch does your name imply? A wonderfully named San Francisco company perfectly illustrates the information per inch principle. The company is NameLab, a company that specializes in naming products. With lightning speed, NameLab's name suggests the company takes a near-scientific, analytical approach to developing names, something distinct in its industry. Beyond that, the freshness and slight whimsy of the name also suggests the company's capacity for creative, right-brain thinking. So, NameLab conveys a powerful double meaning to its prospects, with an excellent information per inch ratio. Ask yourself, if you needed a good name for your service, whom would you call first? Names Incorporated, the name company, or NameLab? A week later, which company's name would you remember? And when that time came to name your company, which company would you probably call for help? Give every name you consider the information per inch test. In service marketing, almost nothing beats a brand. The warranty of a brand. A brand is more than a symbol. In the public's eye, a brand is a warranty. It is a promise that the service carrying that brand will live up to its name and perform. A brand is even more important than a warranty. No warranty does enough, because no warranty compensates the warranty holder for the lost time, the frustration, and the inconvenience of suffering the problem and making the claim. The brand, then, becomes even more important because it is the closest thing to a guarantee that the customer will not need the warranty and have to endure the claims process. Brands are even more important to service customers because few services have warranties, in part because many services are very difficult to warrant. How do you warrant, for example, that legal advice will be good, that a waiter's service will be satisfactory, that a tax accountant will find every permissible deduction? In many cases, you cannot. Left without a warranty, the client has only the brand on which to depend. And depending on brands is just what service clients do. A service is a promise, and building a brand builds your promise. The heart of a brand. When a prospect initially agrees to use a typical service, what does he own? nothing but someone's promise that they will do something. The most desirable services, then, are those that keep their promises. This also means that the heart of a service brand, the element without which the brand cannot live, is the integrity of the company and its employees. The value of any brand rises or falls with each demonstration of the company's integrity. The balance is fragile. Every slip can be costly. We've all worked with services that failed us only once, but fatally. They lied or came close. From that one experience, their brand has lost all its value to us. When others later asked us about that company, we may have said very little, but our message was clear, and it spread. A service can be faster, cheaper, better, and still fail if it does not win the confidence of people that it will keep its promises and tell the truth. The heart of a service brand is not artful packaging, slick advertising, or the company name emblazoned on everything from sweatshirts to keychains. The heart of a service brand, and a key to the service's long-term success, is the integrity of the people behind it. Invest in and religiously preach integrity. It is the heart of your brand. What brands do for sales? A brand will have three dramatic effects on your selling. First, consider a common occurrence. Someone hears a positive story about a non-branded company. They remember the story, but naturally forget the company's name, so they cannot pass the story on. When the same person hears a story about a name brand service, he remembers the story and the company, so he can pass the story along and does. Word of mouth for a branded service spreads easier and farther, producing more inquiries. Second, a brand single-handedly converts more of these inquiries into clients. Prospects feel more comfortable and less fearful with a brand name. Third, consider the plight of a typical non-branded service. To justify her choice of a non-branded service, a prospective client must often schedule follow-up presentations with key people in her company. Frequently, a non-branded service will spend more on this lengthy selling process than the initial project is worth. Branded services rarely face that expense. In fact, prospects routinely choose brand-name services virtually sight unseen. Make selling easier, faster, and cheaper. Build a brand. And never underestimate the value of your brand or the difficulty in creating a new one. The 400 Grand Brand. Here's a true story, with the names changed to protect the innocent and the fortunate. Two men, Phil and Don, spent 7 years building a contracting company into a solid business. Now, they aren't famous, but they do well enough. In 1995, another man approached them and offered $400,000 for their business. Phil and Don's contracting company had no inventory, no non-proprietary products or services, no patents or copyrights, and only one employee other than Phil and Don. The company rented a storefront and owned no real estate, no capital assets, and no accounts receivable. A thorough accounting would have revealed that the $400,000 company's only assets were its name and client list. What was the buyer offering to buy? Was it the client list? Couldn't be. Clients used the company's service only once or twice in a lifetime. Repeat business wasn't much better than in funeral parlors. Moreover, the client list had value only if the clients thought that even though the old owners were no longer with the company would still provide the same high quality. In other words, those old clients and any new ones were simply buying the brand. And that is what the businessman offered $400,000 for. A $400,000 brand. Built in just 7 years with relatively little investment. What is a brand worth? Should you try to build one? Thousands, millions, then billions. And, emphatically, yes. A brand is money. Brands in a microwave world. You want a new sound system. Because you love music and hate wasting money on large purchases, you want to choose wisely. But you also have 8 calls to return, a lawn to mow, 1 recital, and 3 little league practices. You are, in short, the typical got-no-time American. You need some way to speed your decision on that sound system. Brands are decision-making shortcuts in a world of people like you looking for shortcuts. Often, A brand is all the information some people will need to choose their next sound system, even though at least one unbranded system is clearly superior and 30% cheaper than the system they choose. Give your prospects a shortcut. Give them a brand. And to speed up the building of your brand, choose an unconfusable name. Communicating and selling. Because services are intangible, marketing communications for services do more than promote them. Communications make services more tangible and give prospects something firm to evaluate. As a result, marketing communications for most services haul around a heavier burden than communications for products. A bright red Porsche 911 convertible, for example, speaks loudly and beautifully for itself. Very few services speak for themselves at all. We implicitly trust most products, but we're far less trusting and certain about most services. We worry that our lawyers and auto mechanics will do more than necessary and charge more than necessary. We worry that the latest weight loss service will fail. We worry that our remodelers will exceed their budget and finish weeks after they promise. We worry that the collection agency we hire for our service will harass our clients worth keeping and collect only a small part of our outstanding receivables. So, unlike communicating about products, communicating about services must make the service more tangible and real and must soothe the worried prospect. The first two rules of communicating about services: make the service visible and make the prospect comfortable. Your greatest competitor. You know firsthand. A dozen things compete for your attention, and you only have so much attention to give. So you must know that your prospects have only so much attention to give, too. Give them powerful reasons to listen to you, or they will give you only ear service. They may listen, but they will not hear. Your greatest competition is not your competition. It is indifference. Many service marketers know this, but few act on it. Instead of talking about the prospect and what she needs, these marketers talk about their company. Instead of showing what they will do for a prospect, they strive to show how good their company is. Instead of speaking the prospect's language, they speak their own. The prospect is thinking, me, me, me. Unfortunately, the marketer is thinking that too. The two fail to connect. Few people are particularly interested in what you have to say. People are interested in themselves. And until you realize that, you will be beaten badly. Your first competitor is indifference. People cannot process two conversations at once. If you deliver two messages, most people will process just one of them, if that. So, say one thing. Saying many things usually communicates nothing. You want the strongest argument for a single, focused message? Ask your prospects. Your prospects have one basic question. What makes you so different that I should do business with you? Your prospects are making the classic statement, give me one good reason why. It's a simple request that begs for a simple answer. Meet your market's very first need. Give it one good reason, and after you say one thing, repeat it again and again. One story beats a dozen adjectives. Pick up a good magazine and glance at a few stories. You may spot a pattern that tells you something. Today, most nonfiction writers begin their articles with an illustrative story. Trial lawyer Jerry Spence almost always makes a point with a story. More marketers should discover the power of stories. Just as stories make articles more interesting and make Spence's arguments more persuasive, they make marketing communications more interesting, more personal, more credible, more felt, and more persuasive. Don't use adjectives. Use stories. Build your case. In the last 3 years, three of my clients have offered the best service in their entire industry. But do their prospects know it? Thousands of them didn't know, and puffery would never have convinced them. So two of the clients commissioned independent customer satisfaction surveys. The scores were astonishing. So they told their prospects. In one case, they told their prospects that the company had received the highest customer satisfaction scores an independent surveying firm had ever recorded. In the other, the company asked the respondents to score the client. The company then translated these customer satisfaction scores into grade point averages based on the traditional 4.0 scales. The company's service quality score was a fabulous 3.96. They built their case. Merely saying you offer great service will never work. You have to document and demonstrate it. Create the evidence of your service quality, then communicate it. Tricks are for kids. A service is a promise. You're selling the promise that at some future date you will do something. This means what you are really selling is your honesty. Tricks and gimmicks aren't honest. Gimmicky headlines, swimsuit models, direct marketing tricks, they're all a form of bait and switch. And these tricks say one thing. They tell your prospects you're willing to trick them. And that tells your prospects that you'll try to trick them again. Don't. No tricks. Being great versus being good. People in professional services are especially prone to think that the better they get, the better their business will be. But the best evidence that superior performance is not critical to success in services probably comes from the financial markets. In the 1995 Goldman Sachs report, The Coming Evolution of the Money Management Industry, the firm confessed that the real business of money management is not skillfully managing money. It is gathering and retaining assets. Marketing, to cut right to the point. Is Goldman Sachs simply ignoring their clients' insistence on performance? Not at all. When asked to rank the most important criteria for choosing an investment firm, clients consistently put return on investment, the best evidence of technical proficiency in investing, below trust and other relationship issues. In one survey, clients rated track record 9th out of 17 attributes, rating it below a sincere desire for a long-term relationship, among other seemingly soft criteria. Prospects do not buy how good you are at what you do. They buy how good you are at who you are. Superiority. David Ogilvy, who turned his genius for advertising into the famous Ogilvy and Mather agency, and later a huge chateau in France, once observed that marketers were wrong to emphasize superiority. Ogilvy argued that you can accomplish just as much by convincing a prospect that your service is positively good. You can test the validity of Ogilvy's observation with your own experience. How often are you really looking for the very best service, the very best babysitter, cleaning lady, or tax advisor? Not often. How often do you even know the best when you find it? Not often. How long are you willing to look to find the very best when someone very good is readily available? Not long. How much more will you pay for the very best, especially if very good is good enough? Not much. How good does anything have to be to satisfy you? Only very good. Anything better is a bonus. And a critical question. How do you respond when a service tells you it is the very best? Skeptically, and not very well. Sounds like bragging and puffing. If a surveyor asks, "What is the main reason you continue to do business with this company?" the most common answer they hear, even from clients of superior services, is, "I just feel comfortable with them." Not superiority, not even excellence. Just simple old leather slippers comfort. The assumption that being the very best is a necessary marketing position, much less a uniquely powerful one, is refuted by experience, your own. Convey that you are positively good. The clout of reverse hype. A gutsy professional firm once demonstrated the weakness of hype by creating a truly unusual ad. Their little ad understated everything. They eliminated almost every adjective. The resulting ad's impact was, even in the words of these professionals who despised hyperbole, remarkable. For days, professional peers stopped the firm's members on the street to remark on the ad. People notice marketing communications that refuse to strain the truth because people notice the unusual, and understatement is unusual. Far better to say too little than too much. People hear what they see. A memorable 1980 ad for an interior decorator in Portland, Oregon, suggested it. The headline read, "The longer your office says struggling young attorney, the longer the struggle. People cannot see your service. They judge your service by what they can see. If they see one thing while you are saying another, people will trust their eyes far more than they will ever trust your words. Look at your business card, your lobby, your shoes. What do your visibles say about the invisible thing you are trying to sell? Watch what you show. Make the invisible visible. Potential buyers are hesitant to consider things they cannot see, so they emphasize what they can see. As a result, visual symbols of a service become important. Many services, recognizing this principle and the principles that services are simply relationships among people, visualize their businesses with the person behind it. Charles Schwab, Henry Block, Colonel Sanders, Dave Thomas, Joel Hyatt, and Wolfgang Puck. Ad agencies have consistently visualized their services through their people, through Leo Burnett of Leo Burnett, David Ogilvy of Ogilvy and Mather, Jay Shiat, Shiat Day, and Mary Wells of Wells, Rich and Green. Consider, too, the leather portfolios that investment firms use to symbolize prosperity, the Doric columns that many law firms use to symbolize longevity, or the padded shoulders that the armed services use to symbolize strength. Prospects look for visual clues about a service. If they find none, they often look to services that do have them. So, provide clues. Make sure people see who you are. Our Eyes Have It, The Lessons of Chicago's Restaurants. Richard Melman is the wizard behind Scoozy's, Ed the Bevick's, and several of Chicago's most popular restaurants. Many connoisseurs take Melman's success as another sign that image is everything, that in restaurants, looking good is better than cooking good. The critics miss the point. They assume that restaurants are in the food business. Not so. Restaurants are in the entertainment business. People go to restaurants for the experience. They go to famous restaurants with great cuisine to see what all the fuss is about, to experience what others have, to see who might be there and to dress up. Melman's success, then, illustrates the wisdom of knowing what business you're really in and selling what people are buying. Like good restaurants, service marketers must create the visual surroundings, from the parking lot to the last page of the proposal, that will enhance the client's perception of quality. Everything visual associated with your service sends a powerful clue about your service. The influence of these visual clues is not superficial. They go to the very heart of your product and your relationship with the client. Watch and perfect the visual clues you send. Metaphorically speaking, the black hole phenomenon. For years, physicists discussed an important phenomenon, the gravitationally completely collapsed object. Physicists knew these objects could answer the question, how did the universe begin and how might it end? Then, some creative physicist devised a better name for it. He called it a black hole. Suddenly the world was interested. The words black hole changed how people thought. Your words matter. One word or metaphor can quickly define your concept and your uniqueness and make your concept compelling. If you are selling something complex, simplify it with a metaphor. The Generative Power of Words. The Gettysburg Address. Lincoln's address vividly demonstrates the generative power of words. The power of words not simply to describe reality, but to create it. The battlefield at Gettysburg was not a testament to heroism. It was an ugly health hazard, a field full of corpses. Nor was that corpse-strewn field a monument to greatness. The North's general, Meade, had bungled the battle, leaving Lee to regroup, but Lee had done no better, marching blindly into slaughter. No one, aside from the people who teach American history or those who have read Gary Wills's Lincoln at Gettysburg, see Gettysburg as it was. Instead, they see Gettysburg as a symbol of heroism and a testament to people's commitment to their beliefs. Our perceptions are changed by words every day. With six ingenious words, "We're number two, we try harder," Avis changed reality in the car rental business. With the personal computer, Apple Computer got computers into homes and accelerated a revolution in civilization. later with two words, desktop publishing, Apple created a concept that made the purchase of that home computer not merely tolerable to corporations, but desirable. In the invisible world of services, where precious little can be shown and everything must be described, words are the ultimate weapons. Active, fresh, powerful words can do more than merely describe reality. Words can change, shape, and even create reality. Remember Gettysburg and the generative power of words. Sometimes it's all in how you say it. The vividness effect. Just as prospects put great value in recent information in making their buying decisions, they also are strongly influenced by vivid information. No great salesman better illustrated this vividness effect than Ross Perot in the 1992 presidential campaign. To sell Perot to people, Perot used two primary weapons. Vivid metaphors, 3 years later people still remember silent sucking sound, and vivid pictures, his famous assortment of colorful charts and graphs. Long after they had forgotten the many dry details of the debates, people remembered Perot's vivid metaphors and pictures. You can find many ways to be vivid, and you should. In your words and pictures, make yourself vivid. As David Ogilvy once said, you cannot bore someone into buying your product. The value of publicity. There are six peaks in Europe higher than the Matterhorn. Name one. Get Inc. Advertising is publicity. Just when the first snows came to Minnesota in 1994, a prospect called me. He was desperate to work with me because of the mountain of publicity I had generated for another company in his industry. I was flattered. But while I did not want to correct the caller, he was wrong. Yes, I had helped generate some publicity for the company. A full-page trade magazine feature, a three-paragraph blurb in a local newspaper business section, and a three-paragraph mention in a national magazine. That was what the company had aimed for. We achieved our objectives, but it was not an avalanche. Why, then, did it seem like an avalanche to this prospect? Because we also ran two large ads in the same trade publication at the same time. In his vague memory, this prospect could not distinguish the ads from the articles. All he remembered was what seemed like a lot of publicity, and he wanted an avalanche too. The prospect demonstrated another principle of marketing. Advertising is publicity. So, if you want publicity, advertise. Focus on buying, not selling. Think how often you have been virtually sold on something but chose not to make the purchase because it was too hard to buy. The salesperson offered all sorts of options, for example, or made you worry about the value of an extended warranty, or offered complicated financing packages that you could not intelligently choose among. Now think of your opposite experiences. Something appealed to you, a little, not necessarily a lot, and the ease with which you could order, pay for, and receive the product ultimately led you to make the purchase. Good marketing must focus on the buy. How clear is your offer? Can the prospect sample the service, thereby reducing their risk? How clear is the price? How easy is it to buy? Make your service easy to buy. The most compelling selling message. What sells? The most compelling selling message you can deliver in any medium is not that you have something wonderful to sell. It is, I understand what you need. The message, I understand, is about the only person involved in the sale who really matters, the buyer. Find out what they want. Find out what they need. Find out who they are. It will take extra time, but it can make the sale. Don't sell your service. Sell your prospect. Talk about him, not about you. More and better marketing is not the answer to every business question. For all its marketing brilliance, for example, McDonald's probably would have fallen into bankruptcy without its brilliant real estate strategy. The strategy that today accounts for most of the company's revenues and $8.8 billion of its book value. For all the brilliant campaigns that established its brand in overnight delivery, Federal Express never would have flown without Fred Smith's skillful negotiating and lobbying in Washington. And without the company's mastery of systems and logistics, Federal Express's clever campaigns probably would have killed the company. To succeed spectacularly in a service business, you must get all your ducks in a row. Marketing is just one duck. But it is one very big duck. Take the case of American Express. In 1972, you could herd American Express's entire marketing department into a bus shelter, just 15 people with a budget of $4 million. Today, few people can count all the employees in the department, and the ad budget alone exceeds $210 million. We hear so much about service quality today, but much of service quality is simply invisible to the client. And for marketing purposes, for the purpose of attracting and keeping business, a service is only what prospects and clients perceive it to be. So, get better reality. Improve your service quality, but never forget that the prospect and client must perceive the quality. Our methods for choosing a service are often wild and seemingly arbitrary, anything but intelligent and cost-benefit-oriented behavior. This suggests that you cannot expect to seize a market just by creating a provably superior service with a demonstrably higher benefit-to-cost ratio. Services are human. Their successes depend on the relationships between people. People are human. Frustrating, unpredictable, temperamental, often irrational, and occasionally half mad. But you can spot some patterns in people. The more you can see the patterns and better understand people, the more you will succeed.
This has been a Time Warner Audiobooks presentation of Selling the Invisible, written by Harry Beckwith and read by Jeffrey Jones. Executive producer, Maya Thomas. Produced and directed by Linda Wolman. Text abridged by Harriet Greenberg. Text edited by John Whitman. Production coordinated by Daniel Metcalf. Tape edited, mixed, and mastered by Gary Fink.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.